Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're stepping into a world that's, well, utterly unique. Think melting clocks, impossible mustaches, those haunting dreamscapes.
We're talking about Salvador Dali, of course.
Exactly. And the fascinating thing is, his greatest creation might not have been just his art, but maybe his own life story.
That's a great way to put it. And our guide today is his autobiography, The Secret Life of Salvador Dali.
Now, this isn't your typical memoir, right? He published it when he was only, what, 38?
Yeah, incredibly young. And it's less about just facts and more like a performance, a grand theatrical construction of himself. Some critics called it a premature self-canonization.
He literally wrote himself into legend. So our mission today is to kind of unpack that, to get inside Dali's head, if that's even possible.
Yeah, it's a labyrinth. We want to explore how he took all these anxieties, these neuroses, these eccentricities, and somehow channeled them into revolutionary art.
And into this massive public persona he built, and figure out what lessons, if any, his, let's say, extreme approach to identity holds for us now.
Because it feels surprisingly relevant, doesn't it? This whole idea of personal branding, curating your reality online. Dali was doing that like a century ago, but in real life.
Totally. He was blurring the lines between madness and brilliance way before it was a hashtag. So this deep dive is really your shortcut to understanding this genius who really marched to his own surreal beat.
Long before anyone else even heard the music.
Okay, so let's get into the story he tells. It starts before he was even born, in a way.
With his brother.
Right, the ghost brother. His older brother, also named Salvador, died just 9 months before Dali was born.
And his parents believed he was a reincarnation.
They did. Apparently, they even took him to his brother's grave and told him, "You are our other Salvador."
Mm.
Imagine hearing that as a kid.
It's intense.
It is. And Dali saw this as like the foundational trauma of his life, this morbidly complex identity. It fueled this lifelong, almost desperate need to prove he was unique.
To prove he wasn't just a replacement.
Exactly. To scream from the rooftops, you know, through his art, through his behavior, "I am an original." It really set the stage for all the self-mythologizing later.
So what was his childhood world like then in figures? You mentioned his parents. The dynamic there sounds pretty critical, too.
Oh, absolutely. He describes his home life in Catalonia as this weird little kingdom where he was the absolute monarch, the king child.
Spoiled, basil.
Utterly spoiled by his mother and grandmother. But then you had his father, a stern notary who was the complete opposite, disciplined, strict.
Ah, so that contrast again, indulgence versus repression.
Precisely. And that tension, that push and pull, really became a central engine for him psychologically. It shaped his rebellions. You could even argue it shaped the tension in his art. He learned about extremes very early on.
And the place itself, mm-mm, Catalonia. Did that seep into his work?
Massively. The landscapes there, the stark plains of Umperdon,
yeah,
the rocky coast near Catacoys, they became the literal backdrop for his surreal dreamscapes. You see it constantly.
That kind of haunting beauty.
Yeah, and maybe something a bit austere, almost primal about it. And then there are these really specific personal things like his phobia of grasshoppers.
Right. He talks about that a lot.
He does, in visceral detail. And they become this recurring symbol of terror and anxiety in his paintings. It's like a private fear made universally unsettling.
So his early art wasn't just like pretty pictures. It was him trying to grapple with these visions.
A desperate attempt, I think, to give form to all the chaos and terror and ecstasy swirling in his young mind. And sometimes even mundane things became profound. There's that weird story about the bread.
The bread basket incident. Yes. Tell us about that.
Okay, so he gets obsessed with this piece of bread his nurse gave him, carries it everywhere, super possessive.
Okay.
But eventually, of course, it gets moldy, inedible, and he describes this as his first real conscious encounter with, like, time passing, with decay.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Right. This seemingly small, bizarre thing planted the seed for his later fascination with soft, melting forms, those famous clocks. It's all about that relationship between permanence and decay, preservation, and transformation.
Finding the universal in the utterly bizarre,
mm-hmm,
classic Dali, even as a kid.
Exactly.
So he's got this intense inner world brewing. Then comes formal education. But the traditional art world, Probably not a great fit.
Not at all. He enrolled at the Royal Academy of Fine Arts in Madrid in 1922, but his real education happened elsewhere.
Where was that?
At the Residencia de Estudiantes, it was this incredible hub, like the absolute center of the Spanish avant-garde at the time. Artists challenging everything.
And that's where he met Lorca and Buñuel.
Yes. Federico García Lorca, the poet, and Luis Buñuel, the filmmaker. The trinity of geniuses, you could call them.
Wow. What were they getting into together?
They were pushing boundaries, exploring everything, cubism, dadaism, and crucially for Dalí, Freudian psychoanalysis.
Okay, Freud. That makes sense.
Huge influence. And Dalí himself was already starting to cultivate his public image, you know, the eccentric dandy, the provocateur. He apparently stunned his professors by mastering classical techniques really quickly.
But it didn't last.
Then he found them boring. His real learning was in those late night arguments, the scandalous experiments, the sheer energy of the Residencia.
And the tie at the Academy didn't end with honors, did it? He got kicked out.
Famously expelled in 1926. The story goes, when asked to name professors for his exam jury, he basically said he was smarter than all of them and refused to be judged.
That takes guts. Or something else.
Right. For anyone else, it's a disaster. For Dalí, it was a coronation. He spun it as proof he'd outgrown the place.
You need to set back into a step up, part of the legend building.
Exactly. It wasn't failure. It was liberation. It just fit his narrative of escalating ambition. Remember that quote? At 6, I wanted to be a cook. At 7, I wanted to be Napoleon.
And my ambition has been growing steadily ever since.
Yeah.
Unshakable self-belief. So armed with that, he heads to Paris in 29, the heart of the avant-garde. He meets Picasso, but his real target is the Surrealists, right? André Breton's group.
That was the goal, infiltrate the Surrealists. But something else happened in Paris that year, something arguably even more significant for him personally. He met Gala.
Gala. Elena Ivanovna, Diakonova. This meeting sounds like it was explosive.
Oh, Dalí describes it as this hysterical, divine revelation, almost psychotic. He saw her immediately as his Gradiva, this mythological figure who would save him.
Save him from what?
From himself, basically. From his own madness, his anxieties, and she became absolutely central. Not just his muse, but his manager, his agent, the co-author of the Dalí myth.
So she wasn't just inspiration, she was the anchor, the practical one.
Absolutely the anchor. He said, I have Gala's love, I don't need anything else. She grounded him, she managed the business side, shielded him, provided the stability his very volatile genius needed without her. Who knows?
Maybe you know Dalí as we know him.
Quite possibly.
And artistically, this Paris period is huge too. This is when he develops the paranoia critical method. That sounds intense. Can you break that down?
Yeah, it does sound intense and it's key, but it raises an important point. It wasn't passive dreaming. That's the common mistake.
Okay, so what was it?
Think of it as an active process. He wasn't just waiting for weird dreams. He was actively training his mind to see connections where there were none, to see double images, faces in rocks, whatever.
Like forcing hallucinations almost.
Kind of. He called it systematizing confusion. Intentionally inducing paranoid-like states to see the world differently, to discredit reality, and then, and this is crucial, using his incredible classical skill to paint those visions.
Making the irrational look real.
Exactly. Making it tangible. It was like artistic jujitsu, using madness as a tool, but staying in control, generating inspiration deliberately.
Wow. And this method leads to some absolute classics, the Lugubrious Game, and of course, the Persistence of Memory.
Yeah.
Those clocks.
Unforgettable. And his film work with Meanwhile, too, on Chien de Loup, L'Âge d'Or, pure surrealism.
Is that where the donkey story comes from?
Yes. The rotting donkeys in the pianos for Un Chien de Loup. Apparently, they were just gleefully stuffing these decaying carcasses into grand pianos.
Oh, my God.
It's pure Dalí, right? Mm. Fusing elegance and total grotesquerie to shock people, to force them to see differently. You can only imagine the smell on set.
Definitely makes a statement.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to his famous line. The only difference between me and a madman is that I am not mad.
That quote nails it. He's claiming control. His methods might look insane, but he insists he's the one pulling the strings. He's the rational master of his irrationality.
But this very confidence, this showmanship, it started to clash with the Surrealists, didn't it? Breton wasn't a fan.
Not at all. Tensions grew rapidly. Dalí's ego, his hunger for fame and money, his somewhat ambiguous politics. It all clashed with Breton's stricter, more communist-leaning group.
And Breton came up with that nickname.
Evita Dollars. Yeah. Eager for dollars. Meant as a cutting insult.
But Dalí,
Dolly loved it. He completely embraced it. Money wasn't corruption to him. It was proof of his genius, proof he could captivate the world. He saw zero contradiction between being avant-garde and being a commercial success. Way ahead of his time on the whole artist's brand thing.
And the final split, the trial.
Oh, pure theater. Dolly gets summoned by Breton's group. He shows up feeling ill, apparently sticks a thermometer in his mouth during the proceedings.
Chris.
That's his story. He gives this rambling, bizarre defense, talks about Hitler's back, kneels down, and finally just declares, I myself am surrealism.
Wow. So he turned his expulsion into a declaration of independence.
Exactly. A total triumph in his eyes. It freed him. Now, he wasn't part of a movement. He was the movement. The Dolly brand was ready to go global.
And his book, The Secret Life, basically ends there, with him heading to America.
Yeah, it concludes with him and Gala arriving in the U.S. in 1940, escaping the war. But he frames it, of course, not as fleeing, but as the conquest of America.
How did that conquest go?
He dove right in, designed department store windows, worked with Disney on Destino, did Hollywood sets, game shows, even a cookbook. It's the start of his classical or nuclear mystical phase.
More controlled, maybe. Grand themes.
Yes, often religious themes, like Christ of St. John of the Cross.
Yeah.
Big, technically brilliant works. He was playing on a much larger global stage now. The celebrity artist was born.
So if we kind of pull back, what's the core philosophy here? It seems like this blend of opposites. Rational, irrational, classic, avant-garde.
Definitely. I think his genius, if you connect it to the bigger picture, was finding a kind of coherence within chaos. That paranoiac critical method, it wasn't just a trick, it was a worldview. Systematically using the irrational to understand reality differently.
I mean, order in the disorder.
Or just finding his order in it and his approach to problems, to adversity. It's fascinating.
Right. He never saw setbacks as failures. Expulsion, disapproval, criticism.
They were all just heroic acts or liberation in his telling. The central plot points in The Legend of Dolly, he was a master of like alchemical transformation.
Turning lead into gold.
Constantly. He built his brand by just refusing to let anyone else define him. That's a powerful lesson, especially today.
Okay, so let's distill this. What does this mean for you listening right now? Dolly's life, his secret life, offers some pretty wild but maybe useful lessons. First, obviously, the power of self-mythologizing.
Oh, yeah. He's the ultimate case study in building a personal brand. He showed that perception can be just as powerful as reality. He created Dolly.
Then there's that mix, discipline and delirium.
Uh-huh. The idea that real innovation often needs both. You need the rigorous technique and the radical, maybe even chaotic, ideas. It's the tension between them.
And maybe my favorite.
Yes.
Embrace your eccentricities.
Yes. He took his phobias, his anxiety stuff most people hide, and made them central to his art, his identity. Our weirdness can be our superpower, you know, the source of our originality.
True. And finally, the need for a gala.
So important. Having that partner, that champion, that support system, someone who believes in the vision even when it's outlandish and provides that practical stability, the anchor.
He really was a pioneer in self-branding, media manipulation. Building this huge persona, his grasp of marketing, of spectacle, it feels incredibly relevant for anyone trying to get their unique vision out there today.
Absolutely.
So let's try to boil this down to three final takeaways, starting with an emotional one.
I think the core emotional drama in the book, underneath all the bravado, is that terror of madness. And his absolute belief that Gala was his only salvation. It's the story of profound, almost pathological dependency. Love wasn't just comfort, it was his anchor to reality. Hmm. It shows the vulnerable human beneath the giant ego.
Okay. And an intellectual insight.
It has to be the paranoiac critical method, not just as a weird technique, but as an active tool for controlled irrationality. The idea that creativity isn't just passive waiting, it can be a systematic process. You can generate inspiration. That's powerful for any creative person.
Definitely. And finally, a universal insight.
For me, it's the relentless construction of the personal myth. Dolly started life feeling like a replacement, overshadowed by his dead brother. He ended it a global icon because he created and performed a story of genius and destiny, and he believed it absolutely. It's about the sheer power of self-belief, the art of shaping your own narrative.
Like he said, each morning when I awake, I experience again a supreme pleasure, that of being Salvador Dali. He lived the creation.
He really did.
So Dali's secret life, it's this incredible, maybe unsettling window into a unique mind. a master of self-creation whose story still challenges us and maybe leaves us with a final thought to chew on.
As you reflect on Dali turning his deepest fears and weirdness into this monumental thing, what about you?
Right. What flaws or strangeness in your own life might actually be the raw material for your most unique strengths, your most creative contributions? How much of your reality are you actively creating? And what story, what powerful, authentic story are you telling the world about yourself? Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.